Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 1, delivered on January 17, 2018. The title of this lecture is Introduction to Finance.
Today, Introduction to Finance. Finance is a subdiscipline of economics. Now, there are some books that will tell you, well, it's a subdiscipline of accounting. No, it is not. We use accounting data, but we also understand that accounting data is entirely insufficient for financial analysis. Simply because, and this is nothing against accounting has to follow strict documentable rules. It has to have receipts. It has to have paper. It has to talk about things that have already happened. And we can't do that in finance. We have to talk about what is about to happen. We also have to talk about costs that cannot be documented. Let me go through something here. Madam, you decided that you were going to major in finance. And we in finance, the faculty, we got made sure that you got a great job in finance at State Barn. And we saw you there at the graduation, and we're sitting there. We sit there at the graduation in our black robes. You are so unworthy of this degree. But inside we're saying, oh, there goes my baby again. And we see you off. 2 years later, you show up at my office. Hi, Professor C. Well, God, I can't remember your name. It's just, wait, we got you a job. You did great on the interviews at State Barn, so you're working. You must have risen in the ranks there. You're doing great. Probably making about, what, $80,000 a year now there. No, Professor C. When I left that graduation ceremony, I got in my car, and I was driving away, and I said, no, I have to live my dream. Oh, what? What was your dream? I wanted to open my own donut shop. I said, what? Yes, and I just got back my full first year of accounting, and I made a profit of $20,000. What do you think of me, Professor C? You know what I say to you? You dumbass. And you start to blubber. You didn't make $20,000. You lost $60,000. Madam, do you understand why that's true? Well, not, yeah, give me a little more of it. She gave up $80,000 to make $20,000. You, that donut shop woman, you go burn down that donut. Well, bring me the donuts first. Let's not get rash about this. But destroy it. You gave up $80,000 to make $20,000. Opportunity cost. The cost of the best foregone alternative. Opportunity cost. The cost of the best foregone alternative. By the way, you're going to notice something. If I repeat something, that means it's important. It might be on a test. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Opportunity cost is the cost of the best foregone alternative. That's what we have to care about. We have to care about indirect costs, hidden costs. We have to care about things that accountants are not allowed to show in financial statements. You are the manager of a new project. Well, we can save some money. We can just pull this managerial person off that other project and put her on ours, save ourselves some money. No, you're not. Because she has cost the other project, you see. I had this, let's try this one. Talk about living the dream. I'm going to use you for this one. You also decided that you did not want to have the job that we had worked so hard to get you. You decided you wanted to start your own gas station. Your own little gas station, you know, one of those little kiosk things. You changed your name to Earl so you could wear a shirt with an oval that said Earl on it. You got yourself a little black and white TV for the back that you could sit on a little stool and watch. Okay. You have the Cocaline truck pull up, sells you 10,000 gallons of gasoline, at $2 per gallon. Okay? Now, you are in perfect competition with lots of other gas stations. You can't really move your price too much away from the prevailing. And you know that everyone else is marking up about 25 cents, 26 cents. So you mark up 25 cents. So your retail comes out to be $2.25. Okay? Nothing about that? Well, once the Cocaline driver has pulled out, he's heading, you're the first gas station on the stop along this highway. And you wave at him, bye, and you go back in and sit down at your sad little stool. And the black and white TV show that you were watching, The Best of Honey Boo Boo, is not on. There's breaking news. Breaking news. Suddenly you're seeing pictures of mushroom clouds. You're seeing pictures of ships sinking. You're seeing photographs of troops moving across miserably desolate land. The news flash is North Korea subject to bombardment, strikes back. American battleships sunk in the North Korean waters. China has allied itself with the North Korean government against the United States and the one or two countries stupid enough to join in that fun. Okay? The guys down the road, the Cocaline truck has gotten the message. Put the price up to $8 a gallon. So they're buying their gas at $8 a gallon. So you see down the road all those other gas stations are now posting at $8.25. And you're just kind of standing out there by the highway. What should he do? No, you're a business person. What should he do? Imagine, I'm Darth Vader. Do you really want me to say, you have failed me for the last time? What should he do? Talk to me.
I don't know, raise the price even more.
Let's be a little, you're okay. I'll let you go with that, madam.
That's what I would have said.
Be specific. Give me a number.
Raise your price to, I don't know, $8.50.
Bastard now. Yeah, that's going a little too far. The point here is you put your price at $8.25. But we got it at $2. I've read about ethics. I know I'm not supposed to do that. I'm a good person. I got my gas at $2 a gallon. So shouldn't he still have his gas at $2.25 if he got it at $2 a gallon? Is he being a greedy, hateful, capitalist running dog, roar, 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 or not? Do you know why? It's not a matter of opinion. He must raise his gas price to $8.25 a gallon. Because what will happen the next time the Cocaline truck comes through, and he was charging $2 a gallon, and they got $8 on the wholesale. He's dead. He has to bring his price up. It is not historical cost that matters. It is not accounting cost that matters. It is replacement cost that matters. Replacement cost. Not what you paid for it, but what it's going to cost to replace it. You know, well, my customers, I can't do that to my customers. They love me. They're loyal to me, and I got to do right by that. You know what? They're going to suck all that gas out of you at $2.25 a gallon, and then they'll just drive by, and they'll forget that your name was Earl. They're not going to care about you. I did them such a favor. They'll stand by me. No, they won't. We're business people. We say all of this stuff about the wonders of being ethical and all of that. But you know, when it comes right down to it, survival is really a lot better than the graveyard. Trust me on that. I go out to the graveyard. Yo, how is it out here? And you know what I hear back? It sucks. I mean, when your only chance to have a walk around is as a zombie, that's not a good life. When you're dead, you are nowhere. So the only way you can survive is to price according to your replacement cost. I am a seller of my own artwork. I run a corporation. It's called Emergent Light Studio. Now, I've got a work of art. It cost me the framing, the dry mounting, the masks, the museum glass. It's going to run me about $250. So you tell me. What should I charge for that?
More than 200.
Oh, a lot more. I'm going to have to charge probably about $800. $250? Well, someone pays me, let's say $300. Okay, well, wow, I made $300. Wait a minute. I have to replace that now with another one for $250 so that I can sell it at the next show with another group of weird gypsies, tramps, and thieves just like me. And I'm also going to have to remember that that was the direct cost. I drove all over Hell's Half Acre to find the subject for that photograph. I have equipment that I have to rebuild every time it gets destroyed walking in a winter wind. Or I have to get my leg patched up when some farmer catches me creeping around his place. Okay, all of that. Then I have to figure in the cost of all of the setup for the art shows, the tent, the framing for the tent and all of that kind of stuff. The hours standing on my feet trying to sell to rich people who want to talk snooty. Oh, I don't like windmills. Those are wind turbines. Anyway, you understand that even to cut through the 250 I had to pay for the one I did, then I got to buy another one. Do it again for $250, and then I got to cover all the costs that were direct, and maybe even something for myself for actually doing this kind of stupid stuff that I do on the side, but it's not really on the side. So replacement cost. You see, that can't be in accounting. That is not what accounting does. Now, they can mark to market as they do now, but that is not replacement cost looking forward. You see, we have to care about what is expected to happen next, not what has already happened. That is how crucial it is in our discipline that we not be taken in because the numbers are in black and white on the SEC's Edgar filing system site for accounting financials. We have to care about what is behind the numbers. You know, there are so many companies, they will report profit for a given quarter or a given year, and a great profit, and the price of that stock will go into the toilet. You know why it will do that? It's simply this. Because we in the market know that that wasn't enough for the risk that we took investing in them. We will punish them. We will beat them into the ground. Oh, you made $16.7 million? Aren't you proud of yourselves? Well, we're going to sell that stock until it is down there about $3 or $4 below where it was at the start of the day. Because we took this level of risk and you came back with this paltry level of profit for us. That is not accounting. That is us thinking about risk and what it is going to cost them to reward us for that risk. Expectations. Expectations are absolutely critical because history doesn't matter to us. What happens next is what matters. I want you to imagine you've been married for 20 years. It's been beautiful. Every night you come home, there's music on, your songs are playing, and you and your significant other have a wonderful evening together, dancing and laughing, playing games, and all that kind of stuff. And one night, you come home, just like any other night for the last 20 years, and it's raining outside, and that seemed a little odd for this time of year, and the thunder rolls. As you open the door, as the door swings open, it's dark in the house. And the thunder rolls. And you walk in, honey, I'm home. And the thunder rolls. And you step in, and you're about to put your keys down, and suddenly there's a dark figure at the other side of the hallway, and you recognize, oh my God, she's got a gun. Automatic. 20 rounds, boom, boom, bam. You get out of there, you crawl back to your car, and the thunder rolls, and you pull out of the driveway, and you drive away far, far, and finally you slow down. 20 rounds out of that gun, and the rain is coming down, and you turn on the radio, and they're playing your song. You are so beautiful to me. And the tears are rolling down your eyes. Can't you see? People are backing away. Okay. 20 years. 20 bullets. That's only one bullet a year. Why don't you just go back, man? Go on. Are you going to go back? Oh, hell no. Because history doesn't matter. It's your expectation of what is about to come that matters. That is all that matters to us, is what we expect to happen next. We've already got all the information in the past put there. It's already there. We can't get any more out of it. Not with a chart, not with some historical pricing model, not with some historical accounting data, not with some historical memories of your song. So, expectations matter, okay? History does not. Stephen King wrote a book many years back called The Langoliers. There was even a movie they did on it about people who got stuck in time. They weren't moving forward. They suddenly stopped moving with the time stream. And they realized they couldn't stay there because the Langoliers were coming. These things that eat the past and make it go away. That was a perfect example of what we talk about in finance. The past is gone. It is dead. Here's the same idea. Sir, I'm picking on you too much. You just got that long hair. Get a cut. Sir, this whole idea of the expectations and all of that kind of stuff, if you had, let me set that aside just for a minute here. I've got to go through one other thing first here. But you see, we have to understand in our business that the accounting numbers are important for us to have, but they're only a starting point. Now, we're going to use a lot of accounting. I'm going to show you how to get raw accounting data or original source accounting data, and it's going to be useful to you in not just this class, but in a lot of other classes too, where you need to do research, and there are some places that are just absolutely excellent for getting the hard original source numbers. One is the SEC's Edgar filing system, where companies put their reports of their financial information. Because you know that they're trying not to lie there, because it's pretty much you lie to the government, that's not a good idea. So you know that they're not playing games, they're not doing promotion, they're not spinning it at all. They're telling you pretty much the glib truth as far as they can. And of course, again though, accounting doesn't tell us everything. And we have to use that as our platform, and then we have to move on. And some of that moving on isn't even exactly numbers. It's thinking about things. So in other words, I can look at the financial information of a company. And then I do some spins and twists, and you'll see how to do these to make it more like what we want to know in finance. For example, profit means really nothing to us. What matters in finance is cash flow. Cash flow. A famous story some years back, a turnaround artist was brought in by the board of directors of a company that was dying. And the turnaround specialist said, I can make your company profitable until the day we go bankrupt. You see, because it, and a great example of this, it's been about 5 years ago, I had an alumni panel speak to my club, my finance club students. And a couple of them were from Caterpillar alumni. And one of the women had gotten pretty far up in the company, and she was being quite honest. Caterpillar has been in serious financial trouble, even though we're profitable. And she said, this is the old finance thing going on. Finally, the company is trying to re-gear itself to look at cash flow instead of profit. Profit is just a number. Cash flow is what keeps you alive from one day to the next. It's not the profit. I've run companies, run most of them into the ground, I'm proud to say. But the one thing that I knew for a fact was that awful, awful night called payroll night, when I had to write the checks, you saw right there, I could put profit on the books every 2 weeks. But that night when I was writing those checks so that the people who worked for me got food for their families for the next 2 weeks, that scared the hell out of me because it was very, very different from the accounting. There were some times when I was lucky to have enough for a Denny's Grand Slam breakfast for myself afterwards. Even though I was reporting profit, it looked great. And I could sucker investors all day long who thought profit was what mattered. But at the end of the day, it was the cash flow that was going to keep me alive or make me close my doors. It was cash flow. So that's one thing that we've got to keep our eye on in this course and in finance in general. But beyond that, we have to get out of the numbers altogether. We have to stop listening to experts on TV. Because if they're experts on TV, that means that they are not able to do it in real life. Same could be said, of course, of me. I ran a brokerage house, ran that son of a bitch into the ground. 24 hours, it was closed. It wasn't my fault, though. The state made me close it. No, seriously, noob. Listen, there was a penny stock scandal in another state. I won't mention the state. I don't go back there. I don't know about statute of limitations and all that. But there were penny stock houses around the state. One was a big, heavy hitter, had brought a couple of relatively important companies public, and then it did a bad deal, and, you know, you screw small people, who cares? Unfortunately, one of the people that was screwed in that stock offering was the mother of a politician. And so they just shut down all of the houses in the state. All the penny stock houses, gave all of our assets to these big dogs that made the political contributions. They gave me the chance to send them a voluntary shutdown statement. And so I did that. I lost my $10,000 surety bond and everything. But it was better than being some hard-timer's old lady at the state prison. So there you go. But anyway, the point is, it's not just the numbers. Go into the stores. Look at what's on the shelves. Look at how the employees are behaving. Look at the inventory. Do they have stuff on all their shelves, or are there shelves that are empty? Also, read the background on the people who are running the company. Look at where their vulnerabilities are. Look at where their strengths are. Is this really a person who is qualified to run this company? What about this guy, the CFO? What about the CEO? What about the COO, the CIO? Look at their credentials. Look at the rumor mill. Even troll the message board. See what the morale level is of the employees. See what the competitors are doing. Listen to the wind. That's part of what we do, too. Rumors are part of our business. I mean, we don't believe a lot of it. We know that there's fake stuff out there. They talk about fake news now, and it's pretty bad. It's toxic. But there's been fake news all along. I was a consultant. I created fake news for companies. I would put out press releases for companies to boost their stock price. You know why I wanted to boost their stock price? It's simple, because then the insiders could sell some of their stock and make a lot of money and give me some to pay for the consulting services I was rendering them. That's how blunt I will be with you. But I was always a good guy, because I always charged them a high price for doing their press releases. I'm going to hell. Okay, where was I? I've gone through the first round with talking to you about what matters to us is costs that really aren't what accountants talk about. We also talk about opportunity, in that regard, we talk about opportunity costs, replacement costs, expected future costs. All of these are what we care about, not the stuff that you're going to see right up front in accounting statements. And again, though, we use accounting statements, and let me not disparage accountants. Accounting created the world we have. But most of you accounting majors, you're an accounting major, right? Do you recognize the name, the Italian name Pacioli? That's what we forget history. Pacioli was a monk, a Roman Catholic monk. He created what we call the double accounting system. He just created it out of nothing. But then, very powerful, wealthy families who were financing all of the exploration of the world around in the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance, they saw this and they said, company or adventure explorer, you prepare Pacioli-type accounting statements and show them to us. And then we will consider using our money to finance your venture into the new world. And it became the way that businesses got investors. The investors with money said, we're not going to just give you money anymore like back in the way old days. You have to give us documented financial statements showing what you're doing with the money and how you are planning to spend the money that we give you. Estimate your costs. Estimate your haul on your explorations in the new world. It became the standard. Accounting did that. It created the system we have now. First the mercantilist system and then the capitalist system. It was all because of you. So any disrespect I show to accountants, well, they deserve it because they're boring and they make more money than finance majors do. But at the same time, they are the creators of the world as we know it. As a matter of fact, accounting was why we have writing. The first week found all these ancient texts in with the cuneiforms and all that. And we thought, oh, the mysteries of the universe. No, almost everything we ever find is nothing but a receipt or an inventory or a shopping list, for God's sake. Almost every ancient text is some kind of an accounting statement. That's sad. Anyway. That tells you how important their world is. But we are the finance people. We say, all right, now, you gave us what it is. Now we're going to figure out what it means. There are different kinds of business organizations. Almost every one of you has run a business. The simplest type is just a sole proprietorship. A sole proprietorship is just a one-person show and that person is all at risk. You get to keep any profit. You're on the line for anything that happens. You, madam, decide you're going to run a lawn mowing service. So you've got a truck, you've got a lawnmower, and you go to rich people's yards and you mow them. And you accidentally run over some rich lady's poodle. I know, right? You gave that dog a show dog trim. She sues you for more money than you can imagine because that dog turned out to be quite expensive. She takes your truck, your lawnmower, and then she goes to your home and she takes your Elvis velvet paintings on the walls, and then she has your house trailer seized. You did really well after college. And right. And then she takes your dog and she shoots it. She takes your Bible and sells it on Craigslist. And then she buys your mother a furry costume and tells her to wear it. Right? Mrs. Fox, it's a good starter. They can do anything to you personally. Running a sole proprietorship is wonderful. I run my own business. But at the same time, whatever happens flows through to you as a person. Because it really isn't a business. It's just a person. Now, you can do something called a DBA. And I've done these in different states. Here in Illinois, I've created several DBAs. Just, it's a doing business as. It's a fictitious name. It's a relatively simple process to get it, but you have to go through everything about business. Make sure you understand it. Everything about business is state. The feds really are side players when it comes to business. Businesses are authorized. They're taxed. All that kind of stuff. That's state stuff. Okay, so you can create a DBA. Now, one I did, and you'll still hear that, and you'll see some work of mine under a DBA, Doing Business As, Dark Wraith Publishing. Now, Dark Wraith Publishing was just a sole proprietorship. That way, people could write a check, and I didn't say write it to me, write it to Dark Wraith Publishing. And you show it to the bank, this is me, so if checks come in, I sign them. And most banks will be pretty cool with that. You've got to show them that the state qualified this and all that. Another one I created some years back was Emergent Light Studio, which then I incorporated several years later and sold the name to the corporation to become Emergent Light Studio, Inc., INC. So DBAs are kind of a good thing, but it's not something you do on a lark. It's something that you would do as a serious thing. So in other words, when you are having those lawns mowed, you will not, well, who do I write the check to? You don't say Ethel Smith. Your name isn't Ethel Smith. Okay. Ethel Smith, you have it. Lawn mowing is my life. Lawn mowing is my life. That's weird. .com. Okay. You have to file taxes. Most people don't. It's interesting now because there are sole proprietorships unquestionably vastly outnumber any other business organization. Babysitting, lawn mowing, house sitting, dog walking, car mechanics in backyards. I mean, anything that has to do with, I mean, you run a back alley car shop. You run a back alley meth lab. And that hat, yeah. Okay. Forgive me, I insult people. I really love you. No, I don't. Nah, man, that's nasty. But what I'm trying to get out here is, in fact, every illegal enterprise, that's the whole trick. And we'll get into this later. I'll tell you how to get illegal money to become legal money, but that's down the road. That's more advanced. And that's when I will podcast, I don't think. But almost all illegal enterprises are essentially sole proprietorships or in some way an informal type of partnership. It's just the reality of it. And this goes from the street level dealer, the person you buy your Molly from, all the way through. Yeah, I know about it. Anyway, don't do that. You come to class so depressed. Clear through to the big international drug lords. They are almost all sole proprietorships or partnerships. They're all at risk. They are not official, but they're operating illegally in two ways. They're breaking the law with what they're doing, but they're also breaking the law with respect to not filing their taxes. If you're a sole proprietorship, you're supposed to prepare a specific tax form called the Schedule C. And that says, well, this was my revenue, these are my costs. And then this is my profit. That goes to your 1040. But then there's another one that you also have to do called the Schedule SC. You take that profit from the Schedule C and you calculate the Social Security tax from it. And then that line where you that calculation goes down and adds to the taxes you owe the government. So it's not quite as easy as it might seem to run a sole proprietorship if you do it legally and do it with licit instead of illicit intent. And I'm sure every one of you, you've gotten money doing some little job. You've always declared it on your taxes, right?
No.
Whoa, don't say no. Say yes. You're on recording.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of the things I found out, it's been going on for more than a few years now. I told you I do all kinds of art shows, all running all over the country and all that. You set up your tent and you're selling there. Right next to you is someone selling soy candles. Over here is someone selling metal trees. I had one year, they put me next to a guy who had a chainsaw. He was doing that chainsaw animal art. You know how hard it is to sell fine art when you got the guy next to you doing that? I went out there, I was almost going to tell him off, and then I saw he was making a giant tree log into a beaver. And then I thought, you know, there is really something karmic about that. And I got so wound up in the, you know, the beaver becomes the wood. Anyway, the thing is that those shows, they've got these IRS agents trolling, prowling these shows. They pretend that they're other artists from the other side, or they pretend they're buyers. And they'll come in and they'll just first tell you how wonderful your art is to taff you up, and then they'll say, so are you making much money at doing this? And what was your name again? And all that. I thought, you know, really? You lame. They're tax agents, IRS agents or state agents, and they're prowling around trying to catch all of the people who do these shows, the gypsies, tramps, and thieves, who never report their income doing it. And it is a staggering amount of money. Another great example, there were a couple of economists who did a study for 1 year of the betting that was going on, sports betting, which is, of course, illegal, the sports betting we're talking about, in professional offices. They did two offices in New York City, high rises, and they acted as, I don't remember exactly how it went, but somehow they were able to track all of the betting that was going on. And it came to a staggering, in a single year, tens of millions of dollars in money was flowing through this illegal betting system in a couple of office buildings in one city. None of it taxed. So that gives you an idea of we lose so much tax revenue that way. It's just ridiculous. Okay, the next one is a partnership. A partnership is more than one person all at risk. And they are jointly and severally liable for what happens. That's why some of you are going to try to get into a partner, become a partner in something like an accounting firm, maybe a law firm, maybe an architecture firm, a doctor's office, something like that. They will make your life miserable for several years until you prove to them that you deserve to be one of the partners. Because once you're a partner, anything you do, they all do. Did any of you see the movie Pursuit of Happiness, the Will Smith movie? That they put those guys through hell, and they chose only the top one because once they take him in, he's part of the program. And so they've got to make sure he's worth it. So if you're just thinking, well, yeah, me and my buds here, we're going to do a partnership so we can do this. Well, you ask yourself, do you really want that guy right there to be your partner? I think not. No. Yes, you have to look carefully for a long time to trust at that level. Now, understand that these two structures here are mortal. They die when you die. Madam, did you know that you're going to die someday?
Yes.
You did. Most people really don't want to think about that. You'll wither, you'll get old like I am, you'll bitch and fuss, and then you'll die. And people will be grateful that you've stopped fussing so much. When you die, a sole proprietorship dies with you. When one partner dies, the partnership dies. That's why you have to structure the partnership agreement very carefully, so that immediately when a partner dies, a new partnership forms by the same name without that partner in it. Okay? So that there is a seamlessness of the transition in death. That's very important for you to know that. That these are mortal entities. Corporations. It's different. The corporation is a legal entity. It is separate from its owners. Its liabilities belong to it. But the downside of that means that the corporation's first responsibility is to pay its bills. Anything that's left belongs to the shareholders. And what is left, that residual claim, the company can do one of two things with it. It can reinvest it, or it could give it out as dividends. Now, I had to consult for young companies. In the young years, you're not going to give dividends out. You've got to keep that money to grow the company, trying to explain to shareholders, look, we put the money back in, the company grows, your stock price goes up. If we give it to you as a dividend, there's nothing we can, it's yours, we can't grow. I stood in front of this one group of shareholders. The officers of the corporation were cowering behind me, and the shareholders were legitimately angry. 5 years they had owned the stock, some of them, and they'd never seen a dividend. This one woman, she just kept talking and talking, and I had to be respectful of her. I just said, look, bitch, I don't have anything for you. I got nothing. You want us to give you that money? Well, there's no chance. Then there's no chance that your stock price will go from the 25 cents a share that it's at right now. But if you let us keep it and keep putting it back into the company, maybe we can grow. Well, you sold a lot of those last year. Yeah, we had a lot of bills. We have to pay our bills first, because if we don't pay the bills, those people can shut us down. They will simply take us to court, and our business will close. You know what happens if I don't give you your dividend? Nothing but you fussing at me at a shareholder meeting. Nothing. You can't do anything to me. But that debt holder, he can do that. He can shoot my dog. He can sell my Bible on Craigslist. You understand? That's all I have for you today. I thank you.